In order to keep bringing you guys tons of free content, we work with brand partners who you'll hear from in this episode, including an advertisement from Zopa Bank.
Welcome back to the Talk 20s podcast. We are constantly seeking ways to excite, soothe, or distract our overreactive brains. And it's easy to get hooked in the process on social media, shopping, alcohol, or something else entirely. This episode, however, is an essential guide to getting unhooked, as we're joined by psychotherapist Tali Foch, who shares her own addiction story alongside tried and tested techniques for discovering healthier habits and reclaiming your freedom. Before we dive in, just to let you know, we do talk about some sensitive issues in this episode, such as addiction and eating disorders. So if that's not helpful for you to listen to right now, maybe come back to this episode at a better time. On with the show. So Tali, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
I have been loving your book and we're going to dive into it in this episode. And I can't wait to kind of dive into some of the amazing things that you've got in here. But first of all, we always start the podcast by getting our guests to show us a picture from this time last year and to give us a bit of a behind the scenes of your life. Like, what,
okay,
can you scroll back for me and have a little look?
This time last year, I had just got off the plane to Disneyland in Florida.
In Florida? Oh my gosh.
This
How
was
exciting.
My husband's 30th birthday present to me.
What a great 30th birthday present.
And
that should be compulsory, by the way. Once you've like completed your 20s, everyone should get to go to Disneyland,
Agreed.
Florida.
This is why. I was like, I've never been to Disneyland before, always wanted to go. Yeah. It's been a dream of mine. My brother was allowed to go when we were younger and I never got the invite. So he was like, and it's his favorite, you know, he's a 37-year-old man, but he's still loves Disneyland. And so here we are, having just got off the plane with our little flowers around our...
Gorgeous. Let me have a little look. We'll show the camera. So it's got off the plane to get there or
got off the plane to get come there?
To get there. Oh, so you were literally just landed. Peak excitement.
Yeah, peak
like
excitement,
very, very exciting.
A bit jet lagged.
Love that. And did you have
Polynesian.
The best time?
We had the best time. We were there for, you know, we were there for quite a hefty chunk of time. We were there for like 10 days, which means you do... There's five parks. You do each park
so
twice if you're Nathan. He wants to, you know. And he is a bit of a, I mean, holidays, he's quite strict on timings. We were up 7 a.m. The first one's into the park.
Wow.
So it was quite intense. I actually got sick halfway through, I think, because he was pushing me to go on all these scary rides. But it was a great, I absolutely loved it. It was, I actually cried when I walked into the first park. Can't remember the name of it now. Magical Kingdom.
Yes.
And there's the big...
Castle. Did you go to all like the parades and everything with Mickey? And
it was like, well, it was a bit awkward when we turned up to Mickey. There were all these kids in front of us waiting to meet Mickey, and it was just me and Nathan.
Hi,
we turned
we're
up.
In our face.
We didn't know how to greet him. Like, do we hug him or do we shake his hand? It was just a bit awkward.
Nice to meet you, Mickey. Love that. You just mentioned your brother there. Were you talking about Max?
I was talking about Max.
Max is not 37.
No, Max isn't 37.
Oh,
no, Mickey, no, I wasn't. Max didn't come with us to Disneyland.
Right.
Max went to, Max was invited with my dad. He went with my dad to Disneyland when he was much younger.
And for people who are listening to this podcast, your brother is Max Foch.
Max Foch, yes.
Who they might know from YouTube if they're a big,
if they watch YouTube.
Yeah. Because he does quite a lot of like very, 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 I was going to say silly videos. Am I allowed to say that?
Yeah, 100%. Well, that's
silly
what
videos.
He markets himself as being silly. So he does some very stupid things.
And he has actually done a video about your book.
He has. Well, I mean, indirectly, he was like, okay, I'm going to write a book also called Hooked, which obviously he didn't really, oh no, that was it. It's all the hate comments from his YouTube. But he also got it published in the British Library with his name on it. So it comes above mine. On the sort of record in the British Library, which is absolutely classic. Max always has to have a one up on me. And then took me to the British Library to show me that.
And what was your reaction?
Did you know
that was happening?
No, he did say to me though, can you meet me at the British Library? And I know when he says shit like that, like why on earth does he want to meet me at the British Library? I knew there was something going on. I was fine about it until what happened was, is his producer, someone put it on to Amazon. And so when people were trying to buy my book, they were directed to his book. And that's when I slightly lost my shit. I was like, come on, just take it off. Like, I get the point.
What would you do if like the book of Max, like someone has genuinely accidentally ordered Max's version of your book and they get it and it's just like, I hate Max and all of these kind of things in it. Like, would you not be fuming at him?
Yes, if he takes anything away from my book, my pre-sales, I'll be so pissed off.
Absolutely.
But hopefully I think it's been taken down now.
Yeah.
So.
Okay, good.
Mine's definitely the better version.
Yeah. Well, tell us a little bit more about this book, because it's called Hooked, and it's why it says on here, why we are addicted and how to break free. Why did you want to write a book about addiction?
So I am an addict myself. I've been in recovery for about 10 years now, coming up to 10 years in September, from alcohol, drugs, and from an eating disorder. So It was, 10 years ago seems like it was quite a long time ago, but I'd sort of suffered with it leading up to that and into my early 20s. Mm-hmm. And then once I went into treatment, I left treatment and I thought, okay, well, I think I want to do something different with my life. And I went to train as a therapist. And did my years of training and then started working at the same treatment center that I actually went to myself. However many years later, got this opportunity to write this book. And I think the point of it was, I really wish I'd had a kind of handbook at the start of my recovery. I mean, I was only 22 when I got sober, so I had no idea really what to expect. It was very difficult because so many of my friends didn't really understand what addiction was. Mm-hmm. So I kind of just wanted to make a manual or something to make addiction digestible, because there is still a stigma around it. There is a stereotypical addict of someone who stumbles home drunk at 4 a.m. or who has really bad gambling debts or whatever. But I wanted to kind of highlight that we're all actually addicted to something.
100%.
Whether it's social media or shopping, we have so many more things to be addicted to in today's world. And so that's why I wanted to write it. And also just, if anyone can relate to it, and also for people who have family or friends that are struggling with addiction, because my mum, she didn't have a clue what to do, neither did my poor brother. So to be able to have something that just explains a little bit about it and what's going on and what they can do, basically.
We're super proud that this podcast is brought to you in partnership with our headline sponsors, Zopa Bank, who are one of the UK's leading digital banks. If you've not heard about Zopa before, they're all about fair, simple, and easy to use financial products. My personal favorite is their Zopa Smart Saver, where you can create personalized pots for your different savings goals. To check them out for yourself, head to your app store and search Zopa, that's Z-O-P-A, and start saving from £1. The interest is payable monthly and is subject to variation. Back to the show.
There's a really heartfelt letter, actually. You mentioned your mum just then. There's a really heartfelt letter from her at the back of your book here. Mm. Can you tell us a little bit more about that letter and what it says in it? Because I think it's quite an emotional piece.
I mean, I recorded my audiobook for the book last week and I had to read this letter out, having not read it for years. I mean, Nathan, my husband, read it. And he was sort of in floods of tears. It's basically when one is in recovery or in treatment center, usually they ask for a parent or a sibling or a very close friend to write what's called a collateral letter, which is basically an opportunity for them to be able to express how your addiction or how your behaviors affected them and their life.
Yeah.
Because the denial when you're in active addiction is so strong that, I thought it was everyone else's fault. There was no way that I was taking any responsibility. And so I think for my mum, it was the first time that she was able to express, the consequences of my addiction on her life. And she sort of, she calls it a monster, which essentially it is. It completely took over. And it was, and I do say this to clients, it was not who I am. It's not all of me, but it was a part of me that grew and developed and was nasty and that stole and lied and was manipulative. And so as I sort of said, reading it now, 10 years on, it feels so distant from my life now, but also God, it caused havoc, right? Mm-hmm. And it was difficult for many people around me, caused lots of chaos and drama.
And how did you think you found yourself in a situation where you did become addicted to alcohol, to substance and to various other things? Like, how did you end? Like, did you find
yourself get there?
How did you get there? Yeah. Because I think for a lot of people, like you say, we feel like, we have an image of what an addict is in our mind. And we think, we don't clearly see how actually it's the tiniest little bits of action that sometimes can land us in that position. So what was that case for you?
Well, it's also to remember that it's also important to remember that addiction is progressive. So it starts off perhaps in harmless behaviors that we kind of justify because everyone else is doing it, especially with the drinking culture. You know, when people say to me, oh, yeah, but all my friends do it. And it's like, yeah, but your friends might not be drinking healthily. But for me, it actually manifested as an eating disorder when I was 14 and I was at school. And I just remember feeling desperately uncomfortable in my own skin. Mm-hmm. And sort of restricting my food or starving myself gave me this sense of empowerment or control that I'd never had before. And, you know, luckily I kind of gained the weight that they wanted me to gain. But addiction is like this, you know, in fairgrounds, they have the game whack-a-mole where you whack one mole on a head, it goes down, another one pops up. Mm-hmm. That's basically what it's like with addictive behaviors, unless you kind of do the real internal work. Mm-hmm. So I put down the eating disorder. I sort of stopped engaging in those behaviors and I started to drink. And, you know, my drinking looked like any other 15-year-old's drinking, you know, taking it too far at parties and passing out or whatever. Mm-hmm. Maybe not everyone does that, which is a good thing. Mm-hmm. And, you know, but then it sort of progressed to, you know, I would behave in inappropriate ways. I would say things or do things that I wouldn't remember, blacking out. My life became unmanageable. I would miss work. I would miss flights. I would miss all those things. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, I'd drink at home. I'd drink at every social occasion. And then when I was in my early 20s, that's when I found cocaine. And that's really when things escalated, which was lucky for me in that, thank God, because it could have continued, if that mm-hmm. makes sense. Like these addictive behaviors can continue. Mm-hmm. And then I ended up in treatment at 22. Once I put down the drink and the drugs, my sort of dormant eating disorder, which we call my primary addiction, mm-hmm. reared its ugly head. And I had to go back to treatment to South Africa, actually, because, you know, it was so very strong because I suddenly was dealing with all these feelings that I'd been suppressing mm-hmm. for many years through my behaviors. But I think, you know, that I was on the kind of extreme end of addiction. And that's the reason I wanted to write this book, was to sort of show that it doesn't have to just be like that. Yeah. It can be the sort of lesser impactful or consequential behaviors that like social media or like shopping that we don't think are having an effect, but actually might be more than we think, mm-hmm. basically.
Because is there, like, can we get addicted to anything?
Yes, we can be addicted to anything. Anything, I mean, I define addiction as using something outside of us to change the way we feel.
Wow.
So if we think about it like that, we can really use anything to change the way we feel. There are so many different things external to us and that we have access to these days that can change the way we feel. And there is this this woman, this doctor, this psychiatrist that I follow, her work, and she actually inspired me to write this book as well. And she's a psychiatrist who specializes in addiction. And she talks about when she first had her first child, and she started reading romance novels in the evening to soothe her, to help her fall asleep. And after a while, she started to realize that she couldn't really relax unless she was reading this romance novel. And before she knew it, she was taking these romance novels to work, and in between patients, every 10 minutes that she had, she'd be picking up these romance novels. And she goes, oh my God, I can't believe it. I cannot put this down. Or my compulsion to pick it up is so strong. I'm addicted to it. Mm-hmm. And I loved that example because it really shows you that is something external that can distract us from ourselves and from our feelings. Mm-hmm. And, you know, everyone thinks reading is healthy. Sure. I mean, of course, you know, I don't want to then say that everyone who's reading is addicted to reading. It's kind of, when it makes our lives unmanageable, that's when it usually becomes an addiction. Mm-hmm. And perhaps we all engage with things that we don't really realize are perhaps addictive or self-destructive because they don't have that bad consequences. Mm-hmm. But it's always good to kind of look more closely.
Well, replace that romance novel with a phone, and I think you'll find that most people, most young people, especially in their 20s and younger, would absolutely say that they have the same behavior towards their phone. Mm. But at what point does it become a problem, do you think?
So I think, with social media addiction is huge. And there was actually, there was a study done quite recently, I think it was actually just before COVID though, which said that 40% of people in their 20s admitted to being addicted to social media. 40%, like that's a huge amount of people.
Yeah.
And that was even pre-COVID. I mean, I dread to think what it's like now because TikTok hadn't even really taken off. And
that must be so much higher.
So it must be so much higher.
But it doesn't surprise me at the same time. Yeah. And I just think for Gen Alpha, like the ones that are growing up, literally who have grown up with like tablets in front of them, it is going to be even higher than that.
I was so lucky. I just missed. So I was at school. I was about 16 when Facebook came out. Mm-hmm. So I just missed that. But, you know, sort of surge or that Snapchat or, things like that. But the sort of way that the sort of short bursts of content release the dopamine levels in our brain, you know, that is so addictive. And I am just like anyone else. I mean, if I open TikTok, it's game over.
Yeah,
I can spend 3 hours on there and it doesn't make me feel good. But it's because it's, you know, it's constantly trying to find the next best thing to watch. And it's completely ruined my concentration. I can't really watch a film anymore these days. That's when you kind of know it's a problem. So if basically your life has become unmanageable as a result of social media or your phone. So sometimes people, for example, wherever they go, they have to look at their phone constantly, or if they're having a meal with friends or family, they have to go, you know, some
they
people
can't
have
be
to,
away from they it. Can't yeah, be away they can't from put it in a pocket or a they bag or
exactly,
something like that. Yeah.
I've known people to have to go to the loo to check their social media. You know, that's when it's making your life unmanageable. And, you know, I, for one, if I don't have my phone with me, I notice it. The good news is that there are things that you can put in place, but it's very difficult. Like if you try to leave your phone by the door when you come home from work and not pick it up until the next morning, you know, I've tried it and it was horrible. It was like, oh my God, I didn't really know what to do with myself. But those are the moments that are really important because those are the moments that we are without distraction. And the other problem with social media addiction or just social media in itself, people overuse, is the comparison element to it. Like, you know, there was another study actually that said 35% of young people said that they felt even more lonely after spending 3 or more hours on social media a day. So like, you know, this
it doesn't bring us together. No,
you know, it's meant to be connecting us, but it's doing the complete opposite because we're not meant for this connection over a phone. We're meant for this kind of one-to-one communication. So, you know, the levels of dopamine that we get as a result means that actually it's way more addictive than we think.
But as a psychotherapist then, is there a way of measuring addiction? Like at what point it's kind of too much to handle and you kind of know that you need to address it? Like at what, is there a specific formula? Like this, is there science behind it? Like research behind it? Like how do you know if it's
so
a problem?
The problem with behavioral addictions is that you can't, unlike with alcohol and drugs, when it's quite obvious when it's become too much, you know, as I say, when your life becomes unmanageable, that's when you know that there's a problem. And with alcohol and drugs, it's a lot clearer. The line's a lot clearer as to when it's too much, you know, your relationships break down, you can't show up for work, that kind of thing. But actually saying that, for me, what brought me to my knees was just the feelings of self-loathing that I had. I had had enough of, you know, feeling so shit about myself. And it was a very, very dark period of my life that my behaviors were exacerbating. So, but it might not be always be that obvious. And, and you know, with social media and phone addiction and shopping addiction, you know, when I get clients who come to see me, they don't come to see me and go, oh, I'm coming for a shopping addiction. They come and see me because they feel really anxious or they feel really stressed and they're really unhappy. And it's only then that we're able to look at the behaviors and identify, okay, I keep doing that, or the patterns of behaviors that are actually self-destructive and that are actually making them feel really bad. And in the book I do write, you know, there's a sort of questionnaire type that I write about, you know, do you identify with these questions? Because it's not black and white. There is, you know, there are many different ways that people's addictions can manifest. But it is, you know, it's not just consequences. It's also feelings. It's also how you feel. Like, how is your life? Does your life look like how you want it to look? Or are there things getting in the way? Like gaming addiction is another one. Like, you know, young people who are addicted. And in fact, actually, really interestingly, I read that it was the average age of gaming addicts is 24. And I thought that was interesting because I assumed it would be much younger, sort of like teenagers. But you know, we can do it on our phones these days. So like there's so much is easier access to it. So it's like, you know, as you were sort of asking, there is no prescriptive, this equals that. But the reasons why we are addicted, there are, you know, different reasons in terms of nature versus nurture, but that's a whole different.
Well, I was going to ask you about the science behind addiction. Like, what is actually going on in our brains when we become addicted to something, whether it's gambling, alcohol, social media, whatever it is.
Yeah.
What is the science that's happening in our brain?
So it's very complicated, but to try and put it very simply, there's three different parts of our brain that are involved. The VTA, which is something that basically releases the dopamine. Mm-hmm. It's essentially about the reward pathway systems in our brain. And they basically get hijacked by our behaviors or by you know, calorie-rich foods or sugar mm-hmm. or alcohol and drugs. And to put it very simply, if we get a nice feeling, our brain gets used to this good feeling, good reward pathway, mm-hmm. And wants more of it, mm-hmm. right? So it communicates, the VTA communicates with the nucleus accumbens and it goes round and round in a cycle. And obviously, you know, there is also a part of our brain that wants, if we have like a nice piece of cake, it wants us to appreciate that as well. And it wants us to go, oh, that was nice. And we remember that that was nice, that we want to come back for more. So that's obviously, that's very simply put, mm-hmm. Because, you know, there are also genetics involved, that there is this whole argument, nature versus nurture. And it's 50-50, right? So 50% say that it's nature and 50% it's nurture. And nature is like the DNA, you know? So alcoholism is hereditary, addiction is hereditary. So it can be passed down from parents or grandparents. And there's a lot of genes that are involved in contributing to this. So like there are some genes that, for example, numb some of the dopamine receptors in the brain so that people actually don't get as much dopamine as another person would. Mm-hmm. And therefore they want more, they need more of the substance in order to get to that same level of high.
How does neurodiversity come into that? Is there any correlation there?
Not that I know of, not that I would be able to speak of. Mm-hmm. But so there's that gene. There is another gene that for some people, alcohol tastes really bitter, mm-hmm. so they're much less likely to become addicted. Mm-hmm. There are many different genes that contribute to it. But then there's also the nurture element to it. And this is, for me, where I do most of my work, because this is about emotional needs not being met. So when we're younger, especially between the ages of 8 and 12, that's when we're developing our sense of self, who we are, what we like, what we don't like, how we interact with our peers. And it's in that point, in that period of our life, that our emotional needs being met is so important. And physical needs also, by mm-hmm. the way, obviously. But if our needs are not met, we develop this feeling of shame. We basically feel that there's something wrong with us. And the difference between guilt and shame, I always say guilt is I have done wrong, whereas shame is I am wrong. Mm-hmm. And it's a really, really big difference. And shame gets born as a result of our emotional needs not being met. And to give a very simple example, you know, imagine being upset about something as a kid and your parent or caregiver, you know, tells you to not cry or to stop being upset about it. That's very confusing because as a kid, we're really upset about this specific thing that's happened or something that we've seen. Mm-hmm. And we're being told by the people that we think are the most, you know, without them, we don't believe we'll survive, especially as when we're younger. They're telling us that that we're being silly or that we shouldn't feel like that. And it's very confusing. And we develop this feeling of, oh my God, there's something wrong with me. And we carry this with us. And this is what then builds our belief systems, our negative belief systems. And this is what we carry with us throughout our lives. And it means, you know, if we have negative belief systems, like I'm not good enough, I'm unlovable, I'm not worthy, our behaviors are going to mirror that. Does that make sense? Mm-hmm. So we are much more likely to behave in self-destructive ways than someone who hasn't got as negative, you know, strong negative beliefs or a strong sense of shame. Mm-hmm. That was a very long-winded answer.
No, it's really interesting because I do think it's something that once you dive in, there are so many elements and parts mm-hmm. to it. And I know that you cover so much of it in the book, and I hope to get as much of the goodness that's in this book into this podcast as well. But you talk about four key pillars in your book, discovery, types of addiction, lows and denial, and recovery. Can you give us like just a brief overview? And obviously if people want to dive into this more, they can go and grab mm-hmm. a copy of your book, but can you talk us through like why those four key pillars?
Yeah. I really wanted to give a kind of journey of an addict throughout their sort of journey before recovery and then once they hit recovery. Mm-hmm. So sort of the discovery element was discovering that they have a problem.
Yeah.
And then each pillar is sort of one step closer to getting to that point of recovery and then maintaining that recovery. And obviously denial is a huge element that stops people from getting to that place of recovery. But it was really just like, I wanted to paint the picture of any person who is going to embark on that journey of, okay, do I have a problem? Maybe I have a problem. Let's look into it a little bit more. Mm-hmm. Let's see what's actually going on here before I can make any decisions or any choices about my behaviors.
Mm-hmm. And what then are the steps that people are then taking? So when they come to, you know, you they're sat in your mm-hmm. armchair? Is it like this? I don't know
it's
how I
not,
imagine it.
It's not as sort of swanky as
no,
this.
Not as swanky as the studio. But when you are sat down with someone and you are trying to help them overcome mm-hmm. addiction, what are the kind of things that you often find yourself putting in place to help support them?
So the first thing when we're talking about any type of addiction with substance or behaviors, the first thing that we need to do is abstain. So to find a period of abstinence. When we get these releases of dopamine in our brain, dopamine comes from the pleasure part of the brain. Pleasure and pain come from the same part of the brain. So once we've had more and more hits of dopamine, imagine it's like a scale like this, eventually to reach what's called homeostasis, which is like a level playing field of chemicals in our brain, we will always feel pain, right? A withdrawal, low, you know, a come down per se. Oh. It might not necessarily be a literal come down, like coming off drugs, but it will always be that kind of like yeah. apathy. It's that sort of ugh feeling. It's yeah. like, you know.
But I think that even when like, you know, I'm trying to be good from like my wedding and not eat as many sugary things. And I notice it.
100%. Like, but this is a perfect example yeah. because, and so basically in order to reach that stage of homeostasis, which is that balance in our brain where we're not, the dopamine is not being constantly released and we need more and more and more to achieve that high. It takes about 30 days in order to reach that balance.
Wow.
Right.
Okay, yeah.
And so you might be finding with sugar, right? Mm-hmm. After 30 days, you might crave it less, you know, yeah. and it might be easier. It becomes more habitual as well, because there is a habit element to this. So it takes, so that is the first thing, which is why, you know, the film like 28 days, I think it's called, mm-hmm. About it being in rehab. All rehab programs, most of them anyway, are sort of centered around this 30-day abstinence, right?
Okay,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
Because if you can get 30 days without your behavior or drug of choice, you're much more likely to be able to mm-hmm. continue with the recovery because your brain chemically has rebalanced. So that's one part of it. The second part, once you've done that, is when the internal work starts. Now, with alcohol and drugs, 30 days is not, it's not then like you can start doing it again. It's very important to abstain completely from those if, mm-hmm. if you think you have a problem with them or an addiction. With things like food, with things like social media, with things like TV or shopping, they are part of our everyday life. So yeah. it's then about finding the, what we call the bottom lines, which are like, you know, these are the rules as to how I'm going to interact with certain behaviors. Mm-hmm. And that will look different for everyone. I mean, for eating disorders, for example, you know, your bottom line is coming up with a meal plan that you stick to and it's very strict that you can't, you know, taper off or eat more or eat less. Social media again might look different, you know, getting a flip phone, like an old school flip phone or like turning, you can lock all these apps on your phone.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Things like that. And everyone will be different. Because after 30 days of abstinence, sometimes people do more, sometimes people do another 30 days and another 30 days. But of course, there is a point where it's like, okay, well, I don't really want to be completely disconnected from the world. So mm-hmm. I need to try and find that middle ground. But it's then really, it's about doing the kind of internal work, trying to figure out where these self-destructive behaviors are coming from. What is it that we feel about ourselves? Because as I said, you know, for me, it was this emptiness and Gabor Mate, this doctor physician who specializes in trauma, he calls it avoid. I would do anything to avoid. Mm-hmm. And that's exactly what it was for me. It was like, I just had this like deep emptiness inside where I felt so self-loathing. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, really hated myself. And only once I'd put all the behaviors down, the drink, the drugs, the eating disorders, was I then like confronted with that. Because essentially, that's what it is for me. It is avoiding, what we are avoiding by behaving in all these addictive ways is our feelings. Mm-hmm. Because, you know, they all these behaviors numb us out in some way, or they give us a sort of controlled sense of how we feel. We know how we'll feel when we drink. We know how we'll feel when we take drugs. We know how we'll feel when we're scrolling on social media. You know, I feel completely numb when I'm doing it. And therefore, you know, what am I avoiding by doing that? Mm-hmm. And essentially for me, it's that's the sort of next part of the work.
Mm-hmm. What are the things, and because obviously, how do we stay safe from, inevitably we're going to be faced with triggers, right? Mm. When we step out into, you know, in rehab, I'm sure, you know, lots of things are taken away and it's important that that is the case. But then when we do try and get back into real life, we're going to be faced with triggers where we're going to want to pick up that phone. We're going to want to grab a glass of Prosecco at an event, a wedding or one of those kind of things. How do you personally manage to get through all those triggers and to not start picking up that behavior again? That must be so difficult.
Well, it was especially difficult in my 20s, my early 20s. I mean, I really say this not to sort of make anyone feel disheartened if they're sort of in their early 20s and starting to give up drink or anything like that. Mm-hmm. But it took me a good 4 or 5 years because I had to completely rebalance my whole life. My whole life had to change. And in recovery, we call it, avoiding people, places, or things. People, places, or things that are going to trigger us, especially in the first couple of years. Mm-hmm. Because we have to remember there are things called cues, which is like the association our brain makes with certain behaviors. So like going to the pub, we associate drinking. Yep. Or, you know, I worked with someone who, whenever he listened to dance music, he would think of taking MDMA, but even if he was just in the car listening to dance music, but because that's where he would love festivals and he'd love going to festivals and taking MDMA, that's what went in hand. So it was, okay, whenever that's my trigger, if I hear dance music, oh my God, I get that sort of, that's the brain making that association. So it's trying to avoid, obviously, the things, especially at the beginning, like the pubs or, you know, taking your smartphone away and having a flip phone for a bit. And eventually, once the brain has kind of rebalanced itself, you have the homeostasis again, it's much easier to kind of avoid those cravings. The other thing is, you know, and it might sound obvious, but being able to have a support system around you where you are able to be honest. Being honest, you know, if we're not honest with ourselves or other people, it's really hard to abstain. It's really hard to be, you know, to stay in recovery. And it's like the ability that the addictive behavior has, or that the addiction or the way our mind works, to kind of get us to fall into the same trap, because there's something called euphoric recall, which I won't necessarily go into full detail, but it's whereby we only remember the good bits. Mm-hmm. Our brain only remembers the good bits of the behavior. So like with my drinking, for example, you know, now I do, but at the beginning of my recovery, I was like, there was no problem. Mm-hmm. Like I was sober and I was like, but I wasn't that bad, you know, like really? Am I an alcoholic? Are you sure about that? And actually that's because my brain was, you know, going into euphoric recall. It was only remembering the good parts of it. So, you know, it's difficult, especially for me. I found it really hard for the first few years because I did miss drinking and I missed, you know, the confidence it gave me and the people that I hung out with. And suddenly I was sort of faced with this sort of emptiness and all my feelings. And I had to really avoid pubs for a very long time. But after about, you know, 4 or 5 years, a pub became something different. I went to the pub to have lunch or, you know, I went to pub to have a Diet Coke with a friend. It didn't have to be, it wasn't then that same thing. So I kind of relearned the cues again. Mm-hmm. And so luckily I don't have cravings for, you know, to drink anymore. Occasionally I'll get the thoughts. That's quite normal as well for anyone who is thinking about, you know, oh God, I'm in recovery and I still think about drinking. Yeah, sometimes I think about, oh my God, you know, at my wedding, I was like, oh, maybe I'll have a glass of champagne at my wedding. But I'm much better. There's so much space now between me and my behavior that it's so much safer. You know, I can have the thought, I can notice the thought, and then I'm able to go, okay, maybe not, you know, maybe that's not right for us.
Thanks for listening to the Talk 20s podcast. If you're still listening, here's a little reminder about our paid partner, BetterHelp. We know that your 20s can sometimes be tough and it's hard to find good therapists to talk to. If this is something you're struggling with too, why not check out BetterHelp? As a thank you for listening, we have a special link that gets you 10% off your first month. Click the link in the description or visit betterhelp.com/talk20s.
And you mentioned friends there and how, like, obviously, did your friends change a lot as a result of going through this?
I mean, that actually for me was one of the hardest bits because all my friends were actually at uni when I got sober. And I was so hanging out with some friends, some people who were a bit older than me. And that was probably the most painful bit because not only was I giving up the drinking and the lifestyle that came with the drinking and who I was when I was drinking, you know, I had to grieve all of that. But I then lost loads of friends, you know, my friendships, and that definitely means they weren't the right people for me in my life. Yeah. You know, if people don't want to hang around you when you've gotten sober, they're not your friends. Mm-hmm. But, you know, my whole persona, my whole life was about parties and about going out and about drinking, and I was out all the time. And so when that got taken away, I was sort of faced with like, well, who am I? And I thought that I was part of this group of people and I'm not. Oh my God, I did have to start again. And that's why it is so difficult for people to make big changes like that in their lives, you know, in their 20s and beyond, because there are so many people that we associate with certain behaviors, drinking, or even social media, you know, like people have friendships based around creating content, you know, and walking around and doing that. And therefore, oh my God, if someone decides actually I'm going to have a break from social media, the other person goes, wait, what? Mm-hmm. Why are you doing that? And so it can become, you know, problematic for friendships. And that certainly was the case for me. And it was very lonely. But luckily, because of recovery, I was also meeting like-minded people who were also at the same part of their journey, you know, getting sober. And there are lots of support groups, whether that's AA or Smart Recovery, that are sort of full of people who are going through the same thing. And that's really bonding, because the sort of opposite to addiction is connection. This mm-hmm. is what sort of they all say, you know. And if you are, this is why being honest is so important, because it connects you with, you know, people who feel the same. And when, as soon as someone else says, oh yeah, I felt like that too, it's like, oh my God, thank God, mm-hmm. I'm not alone. And this is part of the shame, you know, shame dies on exposure. As soon as you're able to share something that you feel really ashamed about and someone else goes, oh my God, yeah, I felt like that too. Or, you know, oh no, don't worry, I'm sure that that's quite normal. It immediately, the shame can't keep surviving in the way it has been. Going off key about friendships, but no. You know, this is why friendships are so important, and you know, finding new ones if the people in your life that don't love the change that you're making or don't support the change you're making, it's okay. It doesn't mean that that change is bad. It just mm-hmm. means that they perhaps aren't the right people for you.
And what are the support groups or the first steps that you would suggest someone takes if they're listening to this podcast and thinking, that's me, like, how do I actually get help?
So it depends. It depends from what. I mean, obviously, the ones that are very well known with alcohol and drugs is the 12-step fellowship meetings. And actually, there are 12-step fellowships with pretty much everything at the moment. There's Gaming Anonymous. Mm. There's Debtors Anonymous. There's Overeaters Anonymous. There's Alcohol and Narcotics Anonymous. So there are so many different types because, you know, as we are realizing in today's world, we are getting more and more addicted to these things. So there is that route. There's obviously also the therapy route, you know, trying to find a therapist. Obviously, I know I would say that because I am a therapist, but mm-hmm. that can be really helpful in identifying your behaviors and going, oh, is this harmful or is this not harmful? Because, you know, whilst we might think we're addicted, maybe something isn't as harmful, you know. So therapy, 12-step fellowship meetings, there's something called Smart Recovery, which has a different slightly different approach to 12-step fellowships. Group therapy is another huge one. Like there's loads of places, support groups that have just group therapy, whether or not mm-hmm. it's about addiction or not, that you can find.
Are there any like charities or good websites that people should go to in particular, or should you speak to your doctor or something like that?
Yeah, definitely. Well, I have to say, if you're deciding to come off substances or alcohol, mm-hmm. please speak to your doctor first. Yeah. Please speak to a medical professional because it can be quite dangerous to do that. Mm-hmm. So going to see your GP, 100%. Mm-hmm. There are charities, there's like Mind that you can access the, to have the sort of free therapy. Mm-hmm. I can't remember any off the top of my head addiction specifically because I'm very much 12-step based,
yeah.
Because that's just given me so much, mm-hmm. you know. But yeah, there's definitely lots of help out there.
Mm-hmm. And if someone is listening to this podcast episode because they are trying to help and or maybe just listen and understand mm-hmm. what someone else is going through, a loved one, that they could be a friend, it could be mm-hmm. a relative, brother or sister, it could be even, you know, someone's child. What would you want to tell them mm-hmm. to help someone?
It's a really good question because unfortunately, there is no right or wrong answer. I mean, the most important thing for anyone who knows someone or loves someone who is going through addiction and needs help is that you can't change their behaviors yourself. And that was something that my mum found really difficult. That's something that my family found difficult. They could see me sort of self-destruct, but they couldn't stop me. But you can support. You can also put boundaries in place. You know, one of the most beneficial things that my mum did, and it might sound harsh, but she kicked me out of the house. She said, I can't watch you do this to yourself anymore. And that was really a very pivotal moment for me because I suddenly was like, oh God, maybe this is my fault, or maybe I am behaving in ways that are quite, that are hurting other people. And it was then really when I sort of thought, okay, shit, I should probably do something about this. And I'm not suggesting all parents kick your children out of your house. Please don't. Mm-hmm. But putting boundaries in place is so important. And you are absolutely entitled to express how someone else's behavior makes you feel. Mm-hmm. The most important thing if you do that is always coming from a place of I. So never being accusatory. That won't work. You know, punishing, accusatory, it will only make mm-hmm. their sort of defense mechanism, the protective mechanism of denial, like go up big time.
Yeah.
So it's always like, you know, being able to say, for example, you know, when another Amazon package turns up at the door, it makes me feel really sad because I know that this is perhaps an unhealthy behavior, or I know I don't see you being very happy with it. Something like that. But as long as it comes from a place of I, it will be really helpful. The other thing is being encouraging, trying to encourage them to do other things just as opposed to just their behavior of choice. I had a mum who asked me, my son can't stop gaming. What do I do? Now, obviously, there is the sort of slightly punitive thing of, well, you can take the console away. But I wouldn't do that straight away. What I would do before that is encouraging them to do other things. So let's go for a walk. Mm-hmm. Even if it's just 10 minutes away at the beginning from the mm-hmm. the gaming console, it can make such a huge difference because there is also such a strong habitual element to our addictive behaviors, like picking up our phone, right? Whilst there is an addiction within that, there is also habit. Mm-hmm. And the habits are so strong, but they can be broken, you know? It's really interesting in a study done quite recently, it said it took just over 2 months for a habit to be formed. And there was also, within that study, it showed that you didn't have to do that same thing every single day in order for it to become a habit. If you missed one or two times, it was about the overall effect rather than being every single day. So even just taking yourself away from that screen for 10 minutes and going for a walk around the block, that can make a huge difference. So yeah, being encouraging, but also I think that, as I said at the beginning of this question, the main thing to remember is that you can't change someone else's behavior. And there are lots of, and to make sure you get your own help. If you know someone that's struggling with it, or if you know someone that you feel completely helpless to mm-hmm. be around and it's painful, to get your own help. There is a 12-step fellowship called Al-Anon, which helps all people who, families of people who struggle with addiction and teaches them how to cope with it. But making sure you get your own help, whether that's therapy or a group setting, mm-hmm. Because for example, my family, they didn't have a clue. And of course, why would they? Which is also why I wanted to write this book, to kind of give an understanding that it's not actually in your control. You know, you can't control whether or not your child or your friend engages in certain behaviors. And, you know, with my eating disorder as well, you know, I'd go for dinner with friends and pretend that I'd already eaten. It was very clearly obvious that I hadn't. Mm-hmm. And some people didn't know how to deal with it. And other people, you know, some of my closest friends were like, this is really painful for me to watch. And it was hard for me to hear that, but actually also was what planted seeds of, okay, what is most important in my life? Is the eating disorder most important in my life, or is keeping these friendships the most important thing for me? Mm-hmm. So, and that was obviously a great seed to be planted.
Some amazing advice there. And I think, you know, we've all usually met someone where you kind of can visually see that behaviors that they're doing probably isn't in the best of them. And quite often we don't know how to handle it. Often we don't know what the right words to say, or we feel like, should I be the person to say that? Will they judge me? Will this ruin our friendship? I just think that's quite a natural experience for most people to go through. And I think some of the steps that you said there, really reassuring, because, you know, if I ever come across that, I'm going to be re-listening to this episode thinking, that's how I'm going to handle it. So thank you for sharing that. And we're going to dive in to a few questions about your 20s in particular.
Great.
So for you, what would you say is your biggest adulting failure? It could be something a little bit funny. It could be related to addiction that you kind of feel that was the biggest mistake. Maybe it taught you a lesson. Maybe it was a little bit funny. Like, have you got a story that you can share with us that you're like, I can't believe I did that?
Fun enough, the thing that comes straight to my mind was actually a relationship.
Okay.
Being the sort of biggest fail. And it was just before I met my now husband. And the reason I think it was such a fail is because I had all this self-awareness. I had all this sort of understanding of what, you know, attachment styles are and what is what and why we behave in certain ways. And I knew it wasn't right for me. And this person was really horrible and, you know, narcissistic and would say things to me now that do make me laugh. In fact, fun enough, I found a letter that he wrote me after we broke up. We were about to move in together. And then he literally said, my body rejects you. I know. He literally said that.
What?
I know.
Who says that?
Exactly. And it would just show, all my friends had said to me before, Tally, what are you doing? Like, this is just weird. Anyway, I just was denying my gut, or denying. And I knew it wasn't right, but I was sort of still going with it because I guess I didn't really want to be alone. Mm. And then I found the other day this letter that he wrote me that literally said all the reasons why he didn't love me. I know. Can you imagine?
But why would you send something like to someone after you've broken up? Like, what does that achieve?
And we've never spoken since. I mean, that was the only thing I got. It was just that letter. But if I'm thinking about in the last sort of, and I was in my 20s, I was in my my mid 20s. I must have been about 26, 27. That was, I think, the biggest fail, purely because I literally was not listening to my whole body. Mm-hmm. Was like, this isn't right. This isn't right. It was like, this isn't right. And I just refused to listen to it because I was so frightened. I was frightened of being on my own. Mm-hmm. I was frightened of, oh my God, will I ever find someone? And that would, I actually think would be even, well, maybe not including all my crazy addiction stories of being drunk and passing out in inappropriate places. I think being that relationship, because it made me so clearly unhappy, but I would not let go.
And how long did that go on for?
Luckily, it wasn't that long. It was about a year. So,
it's still a long period of time, especially, you know, in your 20s and stuff. And like, I'm sure that brought about a lot of different uncomfortable things, like that probably really tested you lots of times.
It was really triggering. You know, he would say things that would actually bring up old wounds. Like, he knew where to sort of poke. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I perhaps overshared with him. He knew too much about my life. And so he knew what would hurt. And I think he behaved in this way because he wasn't happy. But, you know,
do you ever sometimes wonder what happens to people like that? Because I definitely do. And I'm thinking, at what point will you ever come to the realization, or will you just be like that person forever?
Well, it's such a good question, because I think in order for people to change, something big has to happen for them, you know, because denial is so strong. Mm-hmm. Like people are so quick to not take responsibility. But that's just, you know, because it's so much easier to blame someone else than to look at yourself and go, oh, actually, maybe I have a part to play here. But for someone like him, you know, I think he could probably, and he was a lot older than me, actually, he could probably go through the rest of his life and never look inwards, because I think what made him so unhappy was that he had this, you know, hurt people, right? Yeah. You know, people, and it's like that thing of like people who want to dull out your spark are people that hate, you know, can't find the spark within themselves, you know? And I didn't really believe that until this happened, where, you know, everyone else in my life was like, he's bringing you down. Like, he doesn't want you to be yourself. And it was because he so deeply didn't like himself. And that says, you know, that there are lots of people out there, sadly, who can't find that joy or that self, you know, love, or don't have that self-awareness. And so they bring other people down with them, you know? So yeah, that was a big fail. I wouldn't recommend anyone, if you have a gut instinct about something,
go with your
gut. It's, you know, go with it. It's,
and listen to your friends sometimes, because sometimes they can give that little outside perspective where they go, you know.
Notice when your friends say something and you go, you have like a really strong reaction. One of my best friends was like to me, well, maybe it's just not right. And my reaction to it was, I was so angry.
Yeah.
Initially, I was so angry and I was so sad, but it was because I knew she was right. Mm-hmm. And as I said before, that was the kind of seed that was planted. And I was like, maybe it's not right. And that's really hard and painful. But then, you know, luckily it did end because it was definitely not right for me. So yeah, listen to your gut and your friends.
It sounds like you have come obviously such a long way since you know, becoming sober at 22. Like, it's an incredible story and you've obviously put it all into this book here. But we all know that none of us are the perfect person. That's what we really like to put out there on the Talk 20s podcast. And even though you have overcome so much, I'm sure there's plenty of things in your list that you're still trying to get better at and 100%. Work on improving. And we like to kind of normalize that on the podcast, that none of us are the finished product. We're all working through something. So for you, what's that one thing that you're trying to improve in your life right now that you're trying to get better at, if you wouldn't mind sharing?
There's quite a few, but I will stick with, I'm the most impatient person you'll probably ever meet. When I want something to happen, I need it to happen yesterday. And I you know, I work through this in therapy a lot, because it's really painful I'm a control freak, right? I love to have control around things. And the reason I love to have control around things is because I hate not knowing what's going to happen. And actually, that's a lot of why people need to feel the need to be in control, is because we actually, as humans, we hate the fact that we have very little control over what happens every day. And we've only got control with how we respond to it. And, you know, there are things going on in my life at the moment that I don't have control over. And it's really challenging, because it makes me feel completely out of control and it makes me feel unsafe. And so being able to practice patience, which is also my book tested big time, sitting and writing a book, being able to practice patience it's a really difficult thing to do. But being able to trust that everything does happen for a reason. I mean, I'm a huge believer in that. Mm-hmm. Things happen as they're meant to. And, you know, my control can lead me to some really dark places and some real places of panic and anxiety, and loads of very irrational fears. You know, I've developed this health anxiety that has come out of nowhere. You know, funny enough, since I got engaged, I suddenly just developed this health anxiety and I had no idea where it came from. But, these are all these kind of things that as I go through my life, I realize, okay, once one thing has happened, then another thing, there's always something to be anxious about, basically. And actually worrying, for anyone listening who worries a lot, is addictive itself, because it's like a fantasy. We're always worrying about the next thing, something that hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And it gives us a hit of adrenaline. And I 100% am very much addicted to worrying and being feeling out of control, because it gives you, you know, you get that sort of high cortisol levels and high adrenaline levels that our body gets used to. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there's quite a few things, but that was...
Is there any addiction that is good? That's what I'm wondering.
Yes. I mean, as I say, like that I probably would then classify as a hobby. I mean, someone asked me the question, yeah, but you know, professional athletes, you'd say that their behavior is probably quite addictive. You know, yeah. They have to train all the time. Yes, for sure. But it's more than what they're doing in their downtime. Are they, you know, can they, like, let's take football players, for example, do they take some time away from football? Do they spend time with their family, or is it constantly football related? Are they mm-hmm. constantly obsessing about that? But you know, hobbies, we do want to do things that, you know, make us, you know, where we can unwind. You know, we want to exercise, we want to, you know, read romance novels, we want to go mm-hmm. on social media. And that's not bad. It's just when it makes our lives, when we're having negative consequences as a result. Mm-hmm. And that can change, right? We can, you know, someone might not be addicted to social media today, but in next year, because of other stuff going on in their life and feelings that they're trying to avoid, might find themselves becoming addicted to social media. Mm-hmm. But yeah, there's a fine line between hobby and being addicted to something.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. Well, it has been amazing to chat to you today. I do think that anyone should read this book, genuinely, just because you are going to meet people in life who do have these behaviours. But also I think that we're all a little bit, we've all got a tendency to get hooked to different things in the world that we live in. Yeah. And I think it has some tips in there for some of the harder stuff that might be more mm-hmm. challenging to overcome, and some of the stuff in there that could creep into our daily lives as just a thing that we see ourselves doing a lot, just like, you know, mobile phone usage. Okay. So I do think this is an incredible book. Tell us where we can get a copy of this book. And yes. Yeah.
So it's available at any good bookshop. So, mm-hmm. Waterstones or Amazon, and you can pre-order it now. And yeah, publication date's the 14th of May.
So very exciting. Yeah. And that's also my birthday, Tali.
No way!
Yeah, it's coming out on my birthday.
Oh,
even more reason.
That's a really good omen.
Treat yourself on my birthday.
Yeah, as a present for Gabby.
For my birthday. But Tali, honestly, it's been incredible to have you on the podcast. And we always end the podcast by asking our guests, if you could look your 20-year-old self in the eye mm. and give them just one piece of advice, what would you want to say? And I know 20-year-old you was in a really difficult place.
Yeah.
What would you want to say to 20-year-old Tali?
I would say, the first thing I'd say is be a bit kinder to yourself. I mean, the way that I beat myself up, the way that I would talk to myself, that sort of what we call the shitty committee in our head that, you know, is full of all these different inner critic voices, or these critical voices that beat you up for anything. You know, just be kinder to yourself. And I think the other thing I would say is that it's okay if friendships change. Mm-hmm. It's okay if the friends that you have, either, you know, the friendships kind of go in other directions. They might come back together, but they might not. And I think your worth isn't defined on whether or not people like you. Not everyone is going to like us. I think that's what I struggled with so much. I thought everyone had to like me mm-hmm. because if they didn't, it meant that there was something wrong with me. Mm-hmm. And now I'm very comfortable with the fact that not everyone is going to like me. I'm not going to be everyone's cup of tea. So I would definitely say that, because my young 20-year-old self drove herself mad, or, you know, did things that she, you know, wasn't then going to be proud of to try and fit in. And, you know, it takes some time sometimes to find your tribe, you mm-hmm. know, your people, and those people might change. Mm-hmm. So I would say, yeah, I'd say that to her.
Incredible advice. Tali, thank you so much for sharing your wisdom on the podcast today. Thank you for sharing your story as well. I know it's a very emotional thing to talk about, so I really, really appreciate it. And if you've enjoyed this episode, or you feel like it might help someone, please do pass it on to a friend, share the link below, comment and share what you'd like about this episode as well, and leave us a 5-star review whilst we're there. Thank you so much for tuning in, and we look forward to seeing you next week on another episode of the Talk 20s podcast.